Welcome to Brutally Honest with me, Jermaine Pennant. This is our fourth episode and thank you for tuning in. Today's guest is ex-professional cricketer Patrick Foster, who had a gambling addiction that spanned over 12 years and lost and spent close to £2 million. Patrick is brutally honest and it gives you a massive insight in how gambling addiction can take and does take so many lives. Patrick, thank you for coming on to Brutally Honest. Absolute pleasure. I've got your book. I've read it. Thought it was fantastic reading. Anyone out there who's not seen it, read it, it's called My Bites, The Secret Life of a Gambling Addict. It's really touching. And you definitely went through hell and back over them 12 years. That is for sure.
Yeah, certainly have. But thanks so much for having me on your podcast. I really appreciate it. And obviously, it's great what you're doing in terms of allowing people to kind of share their stories and open up about these sorts of things, because it's so important.
Yeah. You was a professional cricketer. You started, was it Durham or Northants?
Yeah, so I was at Northants on the academy. And then signed when I left school, and then combined it with being at Durham Uni for a year as well. So, yeah, that's where it all started for me.
It all started. And we're going to get, well, basically dive straight into it, because you talk about your first experience in going into a bookie. It was, you know, you was a student. You have to a night out, grabbed a few quid and just went to get something to eat and then popped into the bookies. I actually did the same thing. I can remember we did it a few times. My mate used to have a little gamble on the dogs. And after a night out, hungover, the boys popped into the bookies and I followed. And I was like, all right. You know, they had a bit of better insight. I just chose whatever colour looked good at the time. I didn't really know. But that's how you kind of started. And it's easily addictive. It easily can draw you in and drag you in. And next thing you know, your life's spiraling out of control.
Yeah, exactly that. I mean, just as you described it, I'd never done it before. It wasn't something that I'd been brought up with, anything that my sort of family did. And then one day I walked into a bookies, never been in one before, watched a guy play on a FOBT machine. He was playing roulette. I thought, that looks good fun. Had a couple of quid in my pocket. I put it all on green zero purely because it was the only number that was different from all the others. And me being the sort of person I am, I didn't bother with any other number. And as I always say, 12 seconds later, my life changed forever, because not a day went past for the next 13 years where I didn't have a bet. And of course, you're not addicted immediately, but I was hooked because the feeling it gave me was just like nothing else. And I always say that the weirdest thing is I think I spent the next 13 years trying to chase that feeling that I got from that moment. And it would never really happen again. So yeah, it's mad when I look back.
Yeah, it is. I don't have like I said, no one in my family was really gambling either or gambled. So it was all new to me, but it's lucky that I didn't have that addictive personality on that side or got that rush that you got, because I think easily I would have, you know, found myself down that dark path. I have had bets before on Cheltenham and the races, but it's more fun rather than getting that kick. At what age did your career come to an end in your cricket?
Yeah, I mean, in terms of kind of professionally, it was actually when I was 21, so pretty early.
Yeah.
I guess one of the big things for me, and I've got a lot of regrets about some of the things that I did and decisions I made, but when I got released age 21, I kind of gave up at that point. I realise now, and obviously you listen to people, you read about people, and there's not many sports men and women that don't have to deal with a setback at some point. And of course, I was one of those people that thought I'd be able to deal with that moment and I just sort of bounce back and use it to motivate myself. But I didn't. I found it really tough. I probably knew in my heart of hearts that the road back was going to be really difficult. And yeah, just there and then kind of threw the towel in. Of course, I still tried, but not with the same sort of conviction. And yeah, that moment sort of hit me really hard. You never know how you're going to kind of deal with moments like that. And as you know, the transition out of any sport, however long you play it, is tough. And yeah, it hit me a lot harder. And I think maybe because I just had a little taste of it and then it was taken away, it was almost even harder.
And I'm guessing there was no really support from the clubs that were when you got released or the afterlife, because it's the same with football, really. And it's crazy how sports are connected. It was when I got released from, my contract didn't get renewed at Stoke City, and I think it was January 2015. I was at training, having my lunch in the canteen. I got the call up from the gaffer. The coach came down and said, right, Mark Hughes wants to see you. I went in his office and he says, we're not taking the option to keep you for next season or for the following season. There's a contract waiting for you downstairs to sign off. And I was like, well, I was absolutely baffled. I walked out of this training ground. Didn't say bye to anyone. Left the training ground. Didn't sign no paper. Went into my car. I was trembling. Called my agent. And said, this has happened. And he was shocked as well. But then after that, I never saw that training ground ever again, which I spent 5 years there. The boys there didn't really say bye. And then I was lost in the wilderness on my own. I didn't know, right, you know, what do I do now? Right, let's try and find another club. But they don't really put anything there in that. I'm thinking, is that the same for cricket?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, certainly when I played, I think there's a lot more in place now that the Professional Cricket Association do a great job now in kind of preparing people for that moment and the transition out of the game to help people know what they might do or support them when that happens. But yeah, definitely at the time that I got released, it was kind of one day or 1 hour, you're a professional cricketer, mm-hmm. and the next you're an absolute nobody. When that's all you've ever wanted, it's hard when it disappears like that. And as you just said, it's weird because so quickly you're kind of forgotten, and yeah, it's very fickle. And I think that's what probably makes it even harder.
Yeah. So let's get into the betting. At what stage or what year was it when you really got a big payday, which, you know, was amazing for you and thought, right, this is something I'm going to, you know, stick to and really drag you in?
Yeah, I mean, between kind of the moment we just described when I first started and a year into working in London, because after I finished at uni, I went into the city. I was working as an insurance broker, and I was gambling a lot and gambling heavily. But like a lot of people, it was kind of money that I could afford to lose most of the time. It was kind of very much up and down. You win, you lose, and you're kind of constantly just sort of trying to break even. You have a few nice wins, you have a few big losses, but at that point it wasn't kind of ruining my life. And then in 2010, one Wednesday night, I'd had some good news at work. I basically rang my mates and said, look, let's go out, let's celebrate. But because it was a Wednesday night and there was Champions League on, I wanted to put a bet on. So I got there a few minutes early because I never really told anybody how much I was gambling. I walked downstairs to this shop, having been given a bonus. I thought, you know what, I might as well have a go, might as well have a big bet. And I actually put the biggest bet on I'd put on to that point, which was a football accumulator, a six-fold football accumulator. It was 500 quid. I walked upstairs. I didn't think anything of it. It was one of those. It was, well, yeah, Probably never going to come in like normal, don't even think about it. And about 2 hours later, I checked the scores and it come in, and that night 500 quid became 34,977 quid, which is an awful lot of money to anybody really, but relatively to me as a 22 year old guy, it was sort of a life-changing sum of money. And I think my reaction said a lot, because actually most people who'd win that would be running around the bar, celebrating, telling all their mates, buying every drink. I didn't at all. I didn't tell a single person in the world that happened. And I lost it in 4 weeks, 4 or 5 weeks. And that is when my relationship with it completely changed, because not only did I lose it very quickly, I then obviously wanted it back. But also that was the point where I started to just put bigger and bigger bets on, because I thought I could win that amount of money every time. And then I started to lose and started to find that really difficult, got myself in a lot of debt, and the spiral just started to go downwards from that moment onwards. And I think a lot of people don't appreciate that actually, when you have a big win, if you're a gambler, that's when you're most vulnerable, because you kind of are invincible.
Yeah, I'm guessing when you win big, that rush is amazing, that you just want, and then you want that again, and then you're constantly chasing, and once you lose it, you want that feeling again. So yeah, it's a hard situation to be in. It's very difficult once you get that massive win. But I read in your book that you won that big, the 34K, and when you went to obviously go to the bookers and you showed them the ticket, they said we'll pay you a small from in cash, £1,000, and the rest can even be on your card that you paid with, which will take a week, or will set up an account for you. That's dangerous. That's from them. It's like they're enticing you to, you know, with a little carrot, come in more, you know, just asking, say, do you want an account? Because, you know, once you get an account, what's going to happen? You're going to spunk all that money, and then you're going to go on that wheel.
Yeah, exactly that. They definitely knew what they were doing. And I guess at that time I fell foul of the system, in the sense that there was probably no social responsibility whatsoever. And as far as kind of bookies were concerned, it was, well, you've taken that amount of money off us, we want to get it back as quickly as possible. And when I was doing it in the shops, it's weird, because I always say, when I was doing it in the shops, money's real. Like, most of it was cash. If you lose a large amount of cash, it kind of hurts. But as soon as it moved online, it didn't feel like real money. But also it meant I could do it kind of anytime, any place. So I went from having to like sort of have a routine in my working day as to when I'd go in the bookies at kind of my breaks, lunchtime, after work. Now it was where I can sit at my desk and do it. And of course, being me and being kind of hooked on it like I was, it just meant that I did it all the time.
Yeah, I just want to make people aware that the bookies, I'm going to try and compare them to drug dealers, because they're actually worse, because you don't get drug dealers handing out free drugs, you know, but a betting company would say, here you go, Patrick, here's £100, here's £200, have a free bet, you know. So for an addict to get free, the doses is absolutely shocking. It's shocking. It's like enticing you. Here you go. Come on. I know you're an alcoholic, but here's another drink.
Yeah, I think exactly that. And that obviously through some of the work that we're doing now as an organization, and me by sharing my story like others are, we're trying to change that mentality, because actually historically they did take advantage of like vulnerable people. And that's just not acceptable, as you say. And one of the things that I write about in the book that is probably the bit that kind of appalls people the most is around the VIP schemes, where actually you're being rewarded for essentially being the biggest loser. And as an addict, particularly as a gambling addict, you've got a big ego, and it only kind of drives that, because you think, oh, well, I'm really important. But not just that, they don't want to lose you as a customer, so you can start to kind of bargain with them. As you said, anyone who needs a free bet doesn't have enough money to bet with. But yeah, I would say to them, look, give me some free bets, because I don't have any money and I'll shut down my account. And of course they're going to give it to me, because they know I'm going to come back and they're going to get it all back at some point. So yeah, culturally, like, it definitely, the industry definitely has to change, because it just can't do that to people. Gambling should be something that people can kind of, if they're going to do it, they should be able to only be able to gamble with money that they can afford to lose. But actually, that's not the case for so many people. And I was in debt, and yet I was kind of almost being enticed into gambling more. And that was tough, as you said.
Let's talk about the debt. I've read in your book that, you know, when you moved on to be a school teacher, and then you had to ask at some point your students' parents for money to help that addiction, to get that gambling, and that kind of spiraled out of control. How hard must have, well, in the book it told you how terrified you are every day going into work, having to do your job, but then knowing the parents and school going to find out. How hard was that for you?
Yeah, it was like almost impossible to describe how hard it was, particularly at the end when there were just so many people. I mean, obviously, I kind of abused my position as a private school teacher. I had access to that information. And yeah, that in itself almost became like an addiction, because I always say to people that was a bit of a gamble in itself, because you sort of emailing or ringing up these parents and then you're thinking, right, are they going to come back? And it was like winning a bet, because if one of them came back and said, yeah, I'll give you the money, it replicated that feeling. And if they didn't, well, I just moved on to another one. But the debt is like a horrible thing. And when you owe people money, it's not nice at all. And the social anxiety that came with it was like at times like debilitating, because it was just horrible. And people say, yeah, but it was your own fault kind of thing. And I get that. But that's what the addiction does to you and consumes you, because you don't really think rationally at all. You just do what you feel is right, but it's not.
Yeah, I talk about that. You know, when things are going bad and you don't open up and you keep it all bottled in, we tend to go back to the things that makes us feel good or relief. So for you, it would be the gambling. So, you know, rather than going to speak to someone, you'd keep a lot of things bottled up that would eat you up inside. And that feeling, you'd want to release it by gambling, because that will give you a sense of satisfaction. And it was kind of the same with me not having a mother around, needing that love. So when things were bad and things were bothering me, I would never tell anyone what really deep issues I had. I would go out and seek validation. I'd go and text another girl when I would had a girlfriend. I'd go and, you know, go out to a club and try and, you know, enjoy time with a girl. So it's important for people to know that doesn't matter how down you are, do not be embarrassed, and you always should try and find someone to speak to and release some of that stuff that's built up, because it will eat you away and ultimately you in the future absolutely regret it.
Yeah, absolutely. I couldn't agree with you more. And I always use the term, like, I used to escape to what felt like a safe place.
Yeah.
But it was the most dangerous place I could be. Because when I was gambling, I didn't think about anything else except gambling. And because of the sort of frequency of it, I could do it all the time. It was just a way of sort of running away from the way I was feeling and my emotion. And then as soon as I didn't do it, I'd start to have those feelings. I didn't like it. So you just go back and do it again. And that's where you're just doing it all the time. And as soon as I was able to take gambling, and obviously I had to do it in a very protected environment, but as soon as I was able to take away the gambling, understand it was all right to have those feelings and be that way and talk about them, it replaced the gambling. And I always say now, people say to me, how do you replace gambling? It's hard. Nothing will ever replace it. But the one thing that makes the biggest difference to me is talking and being open and honest.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I was kind of in the same situation as when I was on my own in my own company. I would feel inside scared. So I'd go and try and message a girl to get validation, because obviously not having a mother around, the abandonment kind of, subconsciously, I didn't know, but, you know, it was the thought of being abandoned again. And I just needed to, you know, seek validation. In your book, you talk about you tried to had suicidal thoughts twice. Would you say that was probably the darkest part of your life?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it doesn't get any worse than that. And I think for me, like, there just came a point where I didn't really see a way out. I would say one of the ironies of a like gambling addiction is the only thing you think is going to get you out of it is gambling. You think that's going to solve the problem, because you're only one win away from getting rid of the debt. And I and that had happened and worked a few times. And then when it didn't, it was just like, well, there is no way out except this. And of course, the longer it goes on, the worse the kind of mental health side of things is. And yeah, I just reached a point where I thought, you know what, I can't do this anymore. And of course, people think it's like a very selfish thing to do. And in many ways, it is. But actually, when you're in that situation, it's almost like selfless, because I used to think, well, actually, the world would be a better place without me here because of what I'm doing to myself, but also what I'm doing to other people. I just didn't see any way out. I didn't think help was possible. And actually, along the way, I'd actually tried to seek help through certain mediums a couple of times, and I wanted a quick fix and I didn't get it. So I just thought, well, help's not possible. But actually, when I got to that point, I realized the impact it would have on other people. I thought, you know what, like I need to commit to this. Because otherwise it is a matter of life and death. And I didn't want to spend the rest of my life feeling like I did, because yeah, it just kills you.
Yes, it's crazy, your story. Because you almost experienced life and death without your doing, not even to do with you. Was it a trip to South Africa? You was in a car crash, and you was unaware of it at the time. You fell asleep drunk in the passenger seat, obviously a taxi, and you woke up next minute, ambulance, blue lights.
Yeah, exactly that. I was on a night out. I was hammered. I got in a cab. I sat in the front seat. Thankfully, I put a seatbelt on. Yeah. I'd never usually, and it pains me to admit it, but I'd never usually put a seatbelt on in a cab, and I definitely wouldn't sit in the front seat. So I was drunk. And the next thing I knew is I woke up, and unfortunately the driver had died. And I didn't really appreciate the kind of magnitude of what had happened to me at that point. Because if that happens to anybody, it's a huge thing. And of course, just like we were saying, how did I deal with it? I didn't want to kind of face the reality of the emotions that came with it and deal with that. So I just ran away, and gambling was almost medicinal at that point. Same with drinking. And yeah, I never really came to terms with it because I didn't let myself. And of course, it wasn't my fault. And it was okay to find that moment really difficult, because anybody would, but me being me, I just thought, I can't find it hard. I can't talk about it. So I'll just run away to booze and gambling.
It's exactly the same as me. I don't like facing my emotions. I don't like letting emotions on. And ultimately you pay the price. You pay the price when you don't let it out, because it eats you away and makes you do things that you probably normally wouldn't do. I'm going to go back to the betting. They gave you, betting companies gave you around, if I'm right, £110,000 of free bets. That is incredible.
Yeah, I mean, I think, as I said earlier, because I was part of these VIP schemes, they found different ways to reward you. And what the way they reward a lot of people who are kind of their biggest spenders would be to take them to sporting events and things like that. And I never wanted to go to any of these things because people would find out why I was there. There was no way I was going to go watch a football match and people say, well, how have you got tickets? And well, I'm being taken by a company. So I used to turn around to them and say, well, look, I don't want to go. I'm not interested in going. Can you give me the value in kind of free bets? And of course, I needed that because I didn't have any money. And of course, I was thinking, well, even if it's a free bet, if I win with it, I can get rid of the debt. But of course, I just lost it. And if I did win, I just gambled it away anyway. So I certainly kind of, I'm not defending them in any way, but I certainly took advantage of the situation. And as I write about in the book, I put people in, and I'm not proud of it, I put people in different difficult situations, because I used to ring up these operators and say, look, if you don't do this, I'm going to go and kill myself, or this is going to happen. And that's not a nice position for anybody to be in, but that's
how desperate Westwick was.
And my argument is that it should never have even got to that stage anyway. So yeah, it's mad when you think about it. And I think that's why I kind of had a desire to share my story, because I wanted that industry to be aware that, I mean, how can you let someone gamble that much, place the amount of bets that I was, deposit the amount I was doing without sort of stepping in and saying, look, what's going on? Where's this money coming from? Unfortunately, there has been some positive changes. There's still a long way to go. But yeah, it's mad when you think back to it.
I tell you what, Patrick, you've got to give yourself a pat on the back, because the anxiety you went through, the depression that you endured, and your book says we didn't sleep properly for 7 years. I get cranky if I don't have a good night's sleep, never mind over 7 years. And you still need to tell the tale and do something about it. It's absolutely fantastic. How must have that been for 7 years, you know? Because obviously being a school teacher, it's intense with children. Wow.
Yeah, thanks, mate. I appreciate that. Mm. And I mean, it was like tough. I would say actually the sleep bit was one of the worst bits, because it was just so difficult to kind of find the energy. And I became the sort of best actor in the world. I'd go into school, and when I was in front of people, I'd project it would be like I was fine. I was good. I was the happiest person in the world. And then as soon as I wasn't with anybody, I remember going back to like my classroom, and I'd sit with my head on my desk and tired. Used to get home early, sit in like an empty bath and just cry. It just used to take it out of you. And I think that's how I knew I was going to get found out at some point, because it just took away the energy. And every day that went by trying to hide it, it became harder and harder, just because it was so exhausting. But you also become like the best actor in the world, and you find a way. And I think that's the scariest thing about addiction.
Yeah. How did your parents, the family, take it? You talk about how amazing they were, but they obviously had you, they were unconditional love, so they would all support you. Maybe that had a little not negative effect, because you would always get kind of rewarded.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, obviously in the end, and now they've, as you said, they've been incredible. I wouldn't have been able to be what I am if it wasn't them. But as you said, it was almost like during that process, I almost took advantage of that, because every time that there was a kind of, I did show any vulnerability, or there was a kind of chink in my armor, or they noticed something, their reaction was always sort of very supportive. Whereas maybe what I did need was a kind of, look, we can't continue to do this, but I kept getting the support. And I thought at some point that was going to run out. And one of the big things, or one of the reasons that I was very reluctant to admit I had the problem I did until I did, was because I met my now wife in 2016. And as soon as she came along, it was like, well, if I admit it now, I'm definitely going to lose her, and I don't want that to happen. So you've suddenly got something else to lose. So yeah, that's what's amazing about it. Along the journey, there's all these things. But I always say to people as well, when you do finally open up, people's reactions are very different to what you think it's going to be. I'd played in my head this scenario over, I mean, literally thousands of times. This is what he'll say, she'll say. And actually, it was very different when I did it. And that's why it's so important that people do. And
I just want to let people know that you spent close to £2 million in bets over 12 years. £2 million, that's for the 99.9% of the population, that's life-changing. But that's how much the bookies, the gambling scene took you in for. That's frightening.
Yeah, and certainly I didn't have that money. It was, most of it was borrowed. And of course, along the way, the other thing is people forget that the only reason you're able to do it for as long as you did is because at times you do win. But every time I won, no pound that I ever won really went to anything that it should have done. It just went back into gambling. So yeah, it's frightening. And I think if someone's struggling with gambling, I think one of the first things that you need to realize is gambling's never the solution. Most gambling addicts think that gambling will solve the problem. It will only ever make it worse, because actually no amount of money is ever enough.
What point in your life did you think, right, enough's enough? And how did you go and get the help and, you know, become the man you are now? What transition did that take?
Yeah, I mean, I was at the point of no return. I was seconds away from taking my own life, which is not a place that you'd wish upon your worst enemy. And at that point, the biggest change for me was, all through this, I'd thought about myself. I was so like selfish. But at that point, when it was nearing the end, I thought about other people. And I thought, well, hold on a second. I've done this to me and I've done this to them. Like, what have they done to deserve going through this? And I reflected on a lot of moments in my journey, a couple of which we've touched upon. And I thought, you know what? I can't do this because of them, because of the devastation it will leave behind. And that was the point that made me kind of do something and tell someone. I ended up telling my brother. He basically said, look, just please don't do it. He said, just give us a chance to kind of talk to you. We'll try and get you some help. And that was what I needed to hear, I think. And I took myself home and I decided I only had one option, and that was just to come clean. And at times I'd admitted things, but never all of it, because that's what you do. You kind of say what you want, but not everything. And it was only until I was totally honest and I told these people everything, I knew I could move forward in my life. But the biggest sort of turning point was actually, once I'd admitted it, was actually then speaking to someone else who had been in a similar situation, where I got treated in London. I actually spoke to the clinical director, who was a recovering addict. And she said to me, look, I know exactly how you're feeling. I know what you're going through. And that kind of connection just triggered in my mind, well, actually, I'm not the only person who's in this situation. And that connection changed everything.
Yeah, I think there's two battles in it. The first one is admitting that you have an addiction. That's probably the hardest one, because we're always in denial. Well, no, it's fine. I'm just gonna have this one and I'll finish after this. And then, you know, that gets out of control. And then the next one is actually telling someone, speaking about it. Them two battles there are I'm not saying the recovery, but them, you know, the recovery is probably easier than the two, telling and speaking about it.
Yeah, I couldn't have put it better myself. Exactly that. The hardest thing is admitting it. You're in denial for a long time, or you don't want to, but as soon as you're able to get, it's the hardest thing, but as soon as you're able to do that, as you say, you can start moving in the right direction. And then opening up and sharing how you're feeling and finding other people who are actually in that situation is kind of the next stage. And then it gets easier every day. And that is the start of your recovery. And of course, relapse, which is a problem that addicts have, is kind of when you go back to old habits by doing what you were doing. Yeah. So yeah, you're absolutely right.
Yeah, brilliant. Listen, I could talk to you all day long. I said your story is amazing. The book is fantastic. Anyone listening to this, there is hope. You know, speak, reach out. You know, get on the mend, it will get easier. And also read the book Might Bite, The Secret Life of a Gamble Addict by Patrick Foster. It will surely help you as well on your journey. Patrick, listen, I can't thank you enough, mate, for coming on to the podcast today. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Mate, great to speak to you.
And yeah,
going on your journey as well. You're doing great stuff, and sharing it with so many people will help so many others. So top man.
Yeah, brilliant. Patrick, mate, honestly, thank you so much. Speak to you soon.
Cheers, mate.
So that is all for this week. I just want to say a massive thank you to Patrick Foster for taking his time out. And I hope, you know, if there is people out there who's gone through the same story or is going through
the same issues that Patrick faced, there is hope, and I hope his advice does go a long way and can help yourself into recovery. And just want to say a massive thank you to all the listeners for tuning in, taking your time out. I sincerely appreciate it. It definitely doesn't go unnoticed. Feel free to subscribe. No, make sure you subscribe to get latest episodes, which will be coming out next Tuesday as well, on all platforms, wherever you listen to your podcast. So for me, it's a goodbye. Take care, and I will see you next week.